Well, as I see again, I think the last time we had a chat, it was at the party for Bandits, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. January. I think it was January.
That was at Sardi's. It was very nice. Yeah.
That was the way that came about. Ivan Block, who owns Sardi's now, who had bought it maybe 6 or 8 months before, is from Birmingham, Michigan, where I live. And he called me up in sometime in December, and he said... And we met each other. We had lunch a couple of times in Birmingham. And he said, next time you're in New York, give me a call. We'll have lunch. I said, well, I'm coming in January to promote a book. He said, you are? He said, why don't we have a reception for you at Sardi's? He said, have your publisher call me. And that's how it happened. It was his idea. And he picked up the tab for it, too.
I was at... Sardi's in that same room a while back when Ron Powers wrote a wonderful book called Whitetown Drowsing about his childhood in Hannibal, Missouri. And so there were a lot of CBS people there, and I happened to be there, and I was talking to a former producer on that broadcast, no longer the producer. And he began to launch into a tirade against the ex-president of CBS News, Van Gordon Sauter. And, I mean, it was he was very angry because Sauter had apparently displaced him and demoted him and this sort of thing. He was very angry, and so it was about a five-minute tirade. Then I said, gosh, I'm really sorry you feel that way about Van. You know, he and I went to college together. We were great friends back in school. So it was a little embarrassing. At any rate, that was at Sardi's, but it has nothing to do with Touch or No More Leonard. This was... a very amusing book, and different from your other books, at least in terms of the plot, although the mood was still there, and mm-hmm. the way you write was still there, and the dialogue was still there, but the story was different. Now, tell me how all this came about.
Yeah, I think it probably came about the word stigmata in the back of my mind with the sound of it. I think I've always been intrigued by the sound of that word. Catholic background, Catholic education, nuns talking about stigmata. That finally, I think it just happened to surface. I'm not sure now, thinking back 10 years, how exactly the book came about. I'm not even sure. I finished a book in May, and I'm not even sure how that one came about. You know, when you sit right, when I think about it, usually a book begins with a much different idea, and it evolves then into what it becomes because of the characters. Taking a character, auditioning characters as I call it, with one story in mind, and then fooling around with those characters, getting to know them, and out of them comes another story, much more natural to them and their interplay. How Touch came about, I'm not sure. I did a movie. The first movie I ever wrote when I was still at an ad agency, and I did it as a moonlighting job, was a Franciscan Brother recruiter in 1960. And I left the agency in 1961 to go on my own. But I did it for a friend of mine who was an independent producer in Detroit. And so that I gained some knowledge of the Franciscans, their missions that they had. The producer had visited a Franciscan mission in Brazil on the Amazon and had singled out a particular priest, followed him around in his mission activities. And it was that inspired... something, some parts of the story. But the rest of it, the character Bill Hill, who is the sort of a fundamentalist hustler, if you will, a religion promoter, he came out of television. The other one, August Murray, who is a right-wing, extreme right-wing Catholic, militant about it, who wants to bring back the old traditions in Latin and so on. There were people like that in the press, in the news from time to time. that I probably borrowed from.
There's a lot about alcoholism in that book, too.
That's
which
right.
Probably is a reflection of your concern about that disease.
That's right, because I had entered the program a few years before that, and the main character, Juvenile, goes to work in an alcohol rehabilitation center in Detroit, Sacred Heart, and I did research there. I wasn't a patient there, but I hung out there and to get the feel of that place. The priest in the book who runs the center, Father Quinn, is an actual character, who at the time was in charge there.
Well, you paint an interesting description of the patients in that clinic, too, and you show that they apparently come from all walks of life.
Well, that's a fact, sure.
So there is no stereotypical...
No. Mm-mm.
There was one paragraph, if I could find it. It didn't really bother me, but I wanted to ask you about it. I should have marked it. Well, at any rate, you'll remember it. It is the area where you were talking. I believe it does take place in court or a police station, but at any rate, you're talking about a whole bunch of blacks, prostitute, black pimp, a black this, and you name it black before each person. You remember that area in the book?
I think it's where... August Murray was arraigned for disturbing the peace, and he put on his little show in the courtroom. And his
I can't find it. I can't remember where it is. But it kind of disturbed me a little bit because it painted a picture of the criminal justice system as being all black. But maybe that's not inaccurate, at least in Detroit.
Well, it wasn't inaccurate, no. And at the time, because I sat in on arraignments, early morning arraignments, and watched what went on, you know. And in Detroit, with the population that's about 70% black, that's what you're going to find in the courts.
Now, this book was written some 10 years ago, is that correct?
10 years ago.
Why is it just now coming out as a hardcover book?
Because my publisher at that time gave up on it, or didn't feel... They couldn't decide how to sell it. They didn't see a hook. They didn't see a way to label it. I didn't have a name at the time. Other publishers before them were having enough trouble trying to sell me because my work didn't fit into a niche that was easily labeled. I don't write mysteries. I write crime stories. But they're not... You can't say that they're really suspense stories or thrillers in the sense that the plot is important, the most important element, because I think my characters are much more important than the plot. So then when this one comes along, the publisher decided that it was just a very tough title to try to market. So nothing happened until finally in 85 I got the rights back from them and resold it then.
Now, who was the original publisher?
Bantam.
So, did this come out as a paperback?
No, it never did.
Was published
at never all? Was published. Never was published. It was the second book that I sold to them, and then I did two more, which came out. Gold Coast, I wrote within 6 months. Then they brought that one out fairly quickly, and then another one, a Western, my last Western, Gun Sights. And then I moved on to Arbor House in 80.
So this manuscript has been stored somewhere for 10
years. Yeah. I didn't want to bring it up to date. I didn't want to change it. When I got the galleys, I fooled around with a couple of paragraphs, but I didn't make any more revisions than I would have in any set of galleys before publication. But I wanted it to keep it And I felt that it should be identified also, that if it's going to remain a 1977 story, that it should be identified as such, and that's why I wrote the introduction that's in this book.
How does it feel to put all of this work into a novel, a manuscript, and then not be able to have it published?
Well, sure, it's disappointing, of course. And it was even more disappointing because people, friends of mine who read it, thought it was my best work. And reviewers today, some feel it's my best work. Some prefer the crime stories. There are obviously crime stories. There's a gun in this book, but there is really no crime in the book.
Well, I have a friend named Malcolm Bossy. He's a writer. He wrote his best-known book was called The Warlord. And he was telling me that he would write a novel, and he'd send it off to a publisher, and he'd get the manuscript back. The publisher would say, well, this really doesn't meet our needs, or this doesn't work, and this is no good. And so he'd take the manuscript, and he'd put it up on a shelf in his closet. And over the years, he said he had dozens and dozens of manuscripts that had been rejected, and he took the publisher at their word. He believed it. I mean, the publisher said, well, this is not publishable, so he accepted that. And he still has all these manuscripts up there, and I just wonder, you know, you're talking about opinions, aren't you? A publisher or an editor has an opinion, which is not... There are all sorts of horror stories about books being rejected that turn out to be wonderful books.
I've had books that have been rejected... considerably more times than Touch, which was rejected by about a dozen hardcover publishers. A book before Touch, The Big Bounce, was rejected 84 times in New York and L.A. Unknown Man number 89, it sold right away, but it was rejected by 105 producers. They passed on it before Alfred Hitchcock bought it. So rejection means nothing. Unless I think maybe there's some unanimous agreement that this is what's wrong with it, that it'll never work.
But they all have different reasons for not.
Sure, and I think most of them are excuses. They just don't like the story, but feel they should come up with something specific about it, you see.
Well, sometimes publishing is such a marginal enterprise that I have a feeling that the editor wants to watch his tail to a degree and make sure that he buys a property that is going to come over pretty well, don't you?
Yeah, well then when they said this is just this title is just too difficult to try and market, and I remember thinking that it wasn't easy to write, you know. What kind of business is this? It doesn't have to be easy, but if this is your business to sell books, then you go out and sell the thing, you know. And I didn't wake up until I don't know how many books I had written before it dawned on me that first of all, the publisher is not doing you a favor by accepting your manuscript, and secondly, that he's in the business to sell books. And then I find out a little later on that the author is also expected to help sell the book, which is all right. I'll go along with that. It stands to reason, but I don't think publishers do. Certainly, on all books, they don't give it the same push. You know, they're going to give my book more of a push than, say, a first novelist. And that's the way it is.
Well, Arbor, you've done all right with Arbor House, but is there an inherent adversarial relationship between writers and publishers?
No, I don't think there is. Not inherent. I don't know. It's. I have said, well, your publisher is not necessarily your best friend. On the other hand, he could be. But if your books don't sell, then your publisher isn't going to buy the next one. You know, that stands to reason, too. Like, I can understand that. It's a very, very tough business. So if you realize that going in, that out of the thousands of people who write each year, the average income is maybe $7,000, that 70% of the authors who publish in a given year never publish again. Those odds can frighten you to death. So it's best not to know that when you're starting out. Best not to read the trades.
Well, this concept of rejection fascinates me. I have a poet friend who says that he has been rejected literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. But poetry doesn't sell anybody. Doesn't make any money anyway.
Mm-mm.
But his poems come back. And he sends them out again to somebody else. He keeps fastidious records of who he sends them to. And eventually he'll find somebody. But there are always little magazines, college presses and things like that. But eventually he has enough poetry that he's had in print that he'll bring out a collection.
Yeah.
And so he's had about six or seven books that have been published. But it is a matter of constant rejection. But he shrugs it off and continues to write. Is this something also that a writer must expect and try to deal with?
Oh, I think so. You have to have determination that you're going to do it. You have to first recognize if you have sufficient ability to begin and be willing to spend about 10 years learning the craft. I think it takes about 10 years to learn how to write. John D. MacDonald says it takes 1 million words. Would take about the same length of time. You have to expect rejections. I got a bunch of them in the beginning. Then I got following my first sale, which was to Argosy in '51, an agent contacted me. So then from then on, the agent got the rejections. But I've sold everything I've written, with the exception of about 3 short stories. And all of my books, 24 out of 25 of my books, have sold or have been optioned in Hollywood. So that when an interviewer in '85 said, don't you resent the success coming to you at your age? And I resented the question because I had never considered myself unsuccessful. I was selling everything. What more can you do, you know?
Yeah, that was one of the big news pegs a couple of years back when you brought out, what was it? It wasn't the Bravo, was it?
Glitz.
Glitz, that's right, Glitz. Was that, and then,
that was
all of a sudden there was an overnight success.
That was the hook that got me all that attention.
But that was good, too, because you did find a new audience, a whole new audience.
It was wonderful because all of those books now are sitting there, you see. So now the publishers can bring them out and sell them as though this is the first offering.
Do you have any other manuscripts, Gathering Dust simply, that you're going to pop on us?
No, I don't. That's it. I have a...
Darn it.
I finished a book in May, which will be out in April or May of next year, and I'm on page 1 of the next one.
It never stops, does it?
No.
It's like the news business. You know, sometimes we work in the newsroom, and I want to say, turn off the teletype machine. Give us a break. Let us rest a little bit.
Well, I was going to rest. I was going to read for a couple of more months after finishing the book in May. I thought maybe I'd start writing or start thinking in October. But I missed it. I miss work. I miss, because I don't think of it as work. I miss getting involved with new characters and seeing what can develop from their interplay.
So you don't do a lot of just sitting around, I guess, in Birmingham, Michigan, huh?
No. So I've been researching for the last month or more, 6 weeks, on the next one.
Tell me a little bit about life in Birmingham and how you order your day and what you do.
Well, life in Birmingham is very peaceful.
Haven't had a riot there lately.
Have never had a riot in Birmingham. It's a quiet community of mostly, I would say, automotive executives and lawyers and doctors and whatnot. We have a swimming pool in the backyard and a vegetable garden, which my wife tends when she's not reading my manuscripts and telling me where I'm going wrong. Gives me very valuable advice. Tells me when I'm using too many words. I begin work about 9:30. My work day is 9:30 to 6. There are interruptions, but that's it. I stay with it until 6 o'clock every day. Half day maybe on Sunday. Most of Saturday.
Are you like the Bard of Detroit, in the same way that William Kennedy is the Bard of Albany? People call you and get your opinions about crime and politics and things like that?
Yeah, they do. They call and ask me what I eat for lunch, what I do on the 4th of July.
That's very interesting.
We like your sense of humor. Could you contribute something for our column, Detroit Free Press, for our column, Yuck Yucks?
Is there really a column named Yuck Yucks?
There was. I don't know if it's still in.
Have you ever been on a talk show such as the one you described in Touch?
No. No. But I wouldn't be afraid to.
Well, it would seem to me that the reputation Detroit has with all the crime and its murder rate, they'd be calling you on a regular basis to ask you how to stop it.
No, I don't get involved that way.
You know, people are always looking for experts and people to bail us out and to lead us and to give us ideas. And I think to a great degree we look upon our writers as our intellectual leaders.
I think so. But no, I'm never asked to give an opinion.
Are you doing a lot of traveling?
Well, most of the traveling is either here or Los Angeles or... we haven't been to Florida in a while. I went to Cape Girardeau, Missouri last month, where I'm going to set the next book on the Mississippi River. I want to use the river. I've been wanting to use... I don't know, I shouldn't say that, but the river has fascinated me for a long time, and so I'm going to see what I can do with it.
Well, it's certainly nice... being in touch with you again on the occasion of Touch, and it's really a nice book and touching in many respects and also very funny. And I think that Elmore Leonard fans are going to like it because they're still going to feel Elmore Leonard in that book, even though it's not the crime story that you usually have.
Mm-hmm.
So congratulations. I'm delighted that Arbor House had the courage to bring it out, and I'm delighted I was able to see you again. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Don.